Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Is America more driven by caste than by race? Isabel Wilkerson will be here to talk about her new book, Caste: The Origins of Our Discontents. And where is America's forgotten capital of vice? David Hill will be here to tell us about his book, The Vapors. Plus, Dwight Garner will turn the tables and ask me a few questions. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's August 7th. I'm Pamela Paul. Isabel Wilkerson joins us now. She is a Pulitzer Prize winner and the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, which she came on the podcast to talk about a little bit when she reviewed Michelle Obama's Becoming. She is back now to talk about her new book, Caste: The Origins of Our Discontents. Isabel, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So as I alluded in my intro, the last time you came on this podcast, you did come ostensibly to talk about one book in particular, which was Michelle Obama's Becoming, which I used as an excuse to talk about a book of your own, The Warmth of Other Suns. And I don't have to have that excuse to talk about a book of your own this time because you have a new book. Let's talk about how you got from The Warmth of Other Suns to this new book, Caste, because you wrote in your book something, you know, sort of intriguing, which is that you didn't seek to write this book, but you felt like you had to write it. And I'm curious what you meant by that.
Well, with The Warmth of Other Suns, I had spent 15 years looking into trying to understand the Great Migration and why that happened. And so that meant that I spent a lot of time looking at and having to investigate and understand life as it was during that era, from the end of Reconstruction until the 1970s, essentially. And what I discovered was that the word racism, which is a word that often is applied to descriptions of the Warmth of Other Suns, did not actually apply. It was not sufficient. It was not the precise or comprehensive word to describe the structure of repression that was in place from the end of Reconstruction until essentially the civil rights legislation of the 1960s. And so I found that I was using the word caste. Caste was the word that anthropologists and sociologists and others of the era who had gone into the South during the time of the depth of Jim Crow, that they had emerged from that era and that region and that time using the term caste. And it intrigued me when I came across it in the research for The Warmth of Other Suns and decided that that was really the only way to describe it. And so the word racism does not appear in The Warmth of Other Suns. And in the intervening years, especially with events such as Charlottesville, I have been, you know, forced to have to think about the language and think about how we remember our history. And so it's as a result of that that I felt I had no choice but to dig deeper into what I had begun with The Warmth of Other Suns, and it led to this book.
So in those intervening years, did you start to think about another book, but you kept coming back to this idea of caste and sort of switched gears? Or was this the project you went into immediately as a natural outgrowth of The Warmth of Other Suns?
No, it was the former. You're exactly right. I actually had other things that I was working on and was very excited about and very deeply wanting to get into. And this phenomenon kept rearing itself in the news, kept prodding me and poking me to look further at what I had already begun. It would not let me go, essentially. and I, at every turn, I was seeing things that were manifestations of what I had written about, but no one was using the language. We actually need new language to better understand the era in which we live. the old language may not be as sufficient as it might have been, say, you know, during the, you know, the early 20th century, such words as racism, which is a very fraught word, means many different things to many different people and is often conflated with personal animus, hostility, hate. But what we're dealing with now goes beyond that, because actually it's the underlying infrastructure that we've all inherited, that and that has been here all along since the founding of the country, actually since before the founding of the country. And so this the recent events kept drawing me back to what I was not wanting to do. I was not wanting to write this. I really wasn't. And yet it kept pulling at me.
Because it's a very different kind of book. I mean, this is a kind of anatomy of an idea as opposed to a long narrative history told through stories of three individuals and their extended families. And it feels like a kind of shift in gears. And I'm curious what that felt like for you as a writer.
That was one of the reasons why I was not as thrilled to enter into a space in which I was not going to be primarily focused on the narrative nonfiction that I prefer. Although, of course, because this is what I do and this is who I am, it's filled with stories because by definition, that's really, to me, always the propulsive, heart-reaching aspect of the writing. If I'm writing something and I'm not touching someone's heart, then I feel as if I haven't done my job. And so it's filled with that. But there also is this underlying mission to describe something that is a really, truly a foreign concept to American ears, meaning we don't think of the word caste in connection to ourselves. Caste is a word that we often identify with, of course, the original caste system of India, or with feudal Europe and other places, but not to ourselves. It's a term that had been used primarily, and has been used over time, over the decades, actually. But primarily, it was the preserve of scholars, academics who were anthropologists, sociologists, looking at how caste was an appropriate term for the hierarchies that we live with. But it's not something that had reached out to the mainstream. And that was one of the goals of this. So the idea of what you said of digging deep into an idea was a different thing for me. And of course, the way that I work is I cannot do things in a way that is skimming. I have to go deep. And so at a certain point I was, you know, ordering books from all over, you know, from India, from the UK. I was getting, books that had been written in the 19th century. I mean, this is one of the things that I do. I traveled to India. I traveled to Germany. I traveled to England. I was this is just what I do. And that's the other thing is if I'm going to do it, then I have to make sure that I have looked every possible place to tell whatever story I'm telling. And this required drawing upon many, many disciplines, such as anthropology, sociology, history, economics, the law, philosophy. I mean, all kinds of ways of looking at this word, which is a new sounding word to us, to our ears, and trying to understand it for the American context so that I could tell this.
All right. I mean, it's interesting. The word caste is, I think, as you said, new for many people today and thinking about our own country's past. But it's one of those words that has a kind of old-fashioned, uncomfortable, outdated feel because we associate it with India and with terms like the untouchables and Brahmins. And so define exactly what you mean by caste.
Well, caste is the infrastructure of our divisions. Caste is an artificial hierarchy in which people or groups within a hierarchy are ranked according to their value within the system. And that carries many ramifications throughout the culture or society in which the caste system has been created. It has an impact on, and determines, in fact, in the early stages, the kind of work that a person could do, would be permitted to do, would be expected to do, would be allowed to do. It affected the spaces in which people could move about, the places where people could live, the rights that they had in terms of redress protests against, you know, some injustice against themselves. I mean, it basically determined the contours of one's life. And in wherever caste rears itself, that is essentially what it does. And it does its work invisibly, really. It's often unseen. I often describe it as the bones and race is the skin, and then class, for example, is the accents and the education and the clothing and the other things that we can do, accoutrements that we can add to ourselves to adjust ourselves, the things that we have control over. And I often say that caste is so fixed that if you can act your way out of it, then it's class. Mm-hmm. But if you cannot act your way out of it, then it's caste. And so that's one distinction.
In India, for an outsider, I think it's different for Indians who can often differentiate because, of course, there are different groups within India and gradations of skin color. But my understanding is that the caste system had to be so rigidly enforced because it wasn't necessarily obvious, even though the caste classifications were heritable, sort of who belonged to which tier necessarily. You couldn't tell always by skin color alone.
It is incredibly complex. It actually is not just two or three castes, or actually varnas. There are four primary varnas, but then there are thousands of subcastes within those varnas. And so it's an incredibly complex and ancient system. You're absolutely right. It sounds antiquated because it is so very old. And the way that it applies in the United States, however, one way to look at it actually is that each caste system might use different metrics to determine what the hierarchy is, to determine where people fit on the hierarchy. So religion can be used. Obviously, lineage is an ever-present through line for caste. In the United States, the way that caste developed was skin color. What we now call race was the determining factor, but each caste system might use something different. Also, in India, while skin color can be an indicator of one's place, and skin color is hugely important in ranking of people, there are so many other ways that people can identify one themselves by caste, meaning the name, the caste placement, or your caste is often determined by your name, the name carrying either great honor and stature, because if you are Brahmin, and also one of dehumanization that signals your ranking, often related to the occupation that your family had been essentially born for. So it's so very, very complex. And then on top of all of this are the behaviors that become embedded and so second nature that that's another way that people can be recognized for the caste that they might be in. And that actually has connections to ours as well.
All right. I'm going to ask you some very basic questions because I'm trying to get my head around sort of how does caste differ from systemic racism, from class differentiation, from all kinds of prejudices throughout American history. You mentioned religion, and I think back to the 19th century and the early waves of the Irish and then the Italians and the very strong anti-Catholic prejudice in this country. And I'm curious, if does caste apply there, or is it exclusive to the Black experience in America, in your argument?
No, absolutely not. Actually, my argument is, I should say, my thesis is, you might say, that caste affects everyone, and that the essential framework for the American caste system is that there is a dominant caste, those who have been had the greatest power, influence, access to wealth of anyone in the country as a group. And then there is the bottom caste, or the most subordinated caste, which had always been from the very beginning, essentially going back 400 years to the arrival of the first enslaved people. Outside of the hierarchy, you might say, are the indigenous people who suffered such tremendous, almost incomprehensible loss of land and life. And then there are those who arrive to this country in the middle. And that's where much of the tensions in our country often occur, because anyone arriving to what ultimately became the United States had to figure out where do they fit in this ranking. Mm-hmm. There were the people at the very top identified as primarily the English and Northern Europeans. And then as anyone else came into the system, anyone else arriving to these shores, would then have to navigate how they were going to enter the system that they had arrived to. And what they found was that they, in many respects, they didn't have a choice, because as this new world was being created, a place that brought together a convergence of people from all over the world who had never had to interact in the same way that they would in the new world. It's an experiment, you might say. It always has been a project to see how does it work when you bring people from all over the world into one space. Such tremendous hopefulness, presumably, with a project such as this. And yet what happened was that there was a hierarchy that emerged that actually was created, that elevated one group, the people who were the closest to those who were the, you know, so-called founders of it, and then everyone else sort of in ranking order downward until you got to the very bottom, which would be those who had been enslaved, who were enslaved in part because they were so distinctive in how they looked that they could be identified on site. It reminds us that the idea, the concept of race, is a very, very new idea.
This is such rich material, and it feels like you could fill up an entire book just talking about this idea of caste and how it differs from race and from class and from systemic racism throughout our history. But you chose to write about three different countries under three different periods. And I'm interested in why you decided to look at Nazi Germany and India under the caste system, as well as looking at our own country.
Well, if I'm going to be using the word caste, then I have to. I have no choice but to look at the oldest, most recognizable system in the world. So it was obvious from the very beginning. In fact, that was my initial, the purpose of this was to go and look at India, go to the origins of caste and to understand it as best I could, and to understand how it worked and to see what were the differences, what were the parallels. And because I knew very, very well, I was steeped in the American caste system, meaning the Jim Crow America. And then what propelled me to Germany was Charlottesville, the contention over statues and over the symbolism of the Confederacy and Nazism, all fused among the ralliers there. It was essentially a battle over memory, you know, memory of the Civil War and of the memory of whatever slavery had represented based upon how one viewed the history. And actually the focus was not initially on Nazi Germany per se, but it was on initially how Germany has worked through the decades after the war to reconcile its history and to seek to atone for it. And how had they worked through the memory of that era? So I was really inspired by this concept of how do we remember things that have happened in the past? And Charlottesville really brought that to the fore in such a powerful way. And so I then set out to look at how Germany had worked through this. And I never would have imagined what I discovered in the process of researching it. I had no idea of the connections that were far deeper than I would have ever imagined. I mean, the fact that German eugenicists were in continuing dialogue with American eugenicists in the years leading up to the Third Reich, I had no idea that books that were written by American eugenicists were actually huge sellers in Germany and by the Nazis in particular, and that American eugenicists had been invited to consult with the Nazis once they came into power. And that, you know, obviously the thing about it is the Nazis needed no one to teach them how to hate. No one. And yet what they did was they actually sent researchers to study America and then to study the Jim Crow laws to see how Americans had subjugated what I call the subordinated caste, meaning how they subjugated African Americans. And they actually debated and consulted these American laws as they were forming the Nuremberg laws. That was just absolutely stunning and almost incomprehensible, gut-wrenching to discover.
It makes me think, when I look at the comparison of Nazi Germany and Jim Crow South here in America, what is the purpose of caste? Because when you think about Germany, and the ultimate goal was extermination, and in America, it was to exploit and enslave and maintain a certain kind of economic system. And I don't know enough about India to say exactly what the function of caste was there. But does it differ in different societies at different periods of time? Or is there something underlying all three that is the purpose of caste?
Caste essentially is to maintain control of resources, of land, of anything that is of value, and even life itself, by those who design it and choose to dominate others. Essentially, that is the purpose of caste. And these systems are worlds apart in so many different ways. But one of the things that what they do have in common, well, I actually describe these eight pillars of caste that I compiled as I was going through the research and to see where were the parallels. And there were many parallels. But the essential impulse to dehumanize others in order to maintain one's own power is one of the overarching parallels that runs through all of them. But you could say that the differences are in some ways the thing that remind us of how arbitrary these things are. And the idea that if someone can create a hierarchy that's man-made, arbitrary, artificial to begin with, then it means that they can also be dismantled. All of this is actually a creation. It's an illusion that has been around for so long that people begin to believe it and take it to be the laws of nature. And the goal of this work is to awaken us to the structures that we were born into, to awaken us to the inheritance that we did not create it, we are not responsible for the existence of it, but it is our responsibility once we become aware of its existence to then look through it, recognize it, investigate it, learn the history, and then find ways to transcend it.
As part of your research, you mentioned earlier, you went to both Germany and India, and there's so much there I could talk about. I just want to only have time to bring up one part, which is you met with Indian activists around caste. I'm curious what you took away from that experience and in what ways it applied to the caste situation as you see it here in the United States.
For me, personally, the most striking experience was the instant connection. I didn't even expect that. As much research as I had done before getting the chance to actually interact with people, I was stunned at the instant recognition of circumstances and interactions that they might have had. In talking with them, we almost could complete each other's sentences because of the experiences that we'd had. You know, across the ocean, completely different cultures, societies, the essential human response to one's place in the caste system, meaning how people in the dominant caste might interact with those that they have been trained to believe are beneath them, run consistently across cultures. And that's what I mean by the parallels. So that sitting and meeting with them was such an incredible experience because of the instant recognition. And it got to the point where I felt as if we actually had so much in common that it made me feel that as human beings, the question that's often asked is, why do those people do what they do? And it made me actually realize that the question is actually, what do human beings do in a particular situation? That we actually have so much more in common than we've been led to believe, that even across culture and language and nationality and religion, all of these other things, that human beings will respond in certain ways to the inputs that they are exposed to the structures into which they are born, that we are not all that different as we might assume ourselves to be.
One final question about process, because you wrote in your book about how this was, you know, quite unusual to have to finish up a book under pandemic. But what's so interesting to me is that you start your book with the story of this pathogen reemerging from the Siberian tundra. And I just had to know, was that always in the plan, or were you, you know, was that a pandemic-based decision to start there?
I love that you asked that. I didn't know that I was going to be working on this book. As you know, as I mentioned to you, it's been simmering for years, obviously, since The Warmth of the Suns. But I resisted doing this book. And when I heard on the news this almost side story that was just a bare mention on the news about the emergence of these reindeer carcasses that had risen up because of the thawing of the permafrost in the Siberian tundra, and that they had been encased since World War II, 1941, and that 75 years later, due to a confluence of events, exposed the pathogen anthrax that had been dormant in the reindeer carcasses and had risen to the surface and then sickened the indigenous people who lived in that remote region of Siberia. And as soon as I heard that, maybe other people wouldn't think this way, and clearly I guess they didn't because nothing else was done with it. But as soon as I heard it, I knew that's it. That will be the beginning of something. It was symbolic of something that was connected to where we are right now. And that's why it's the beginning of the book.
Well, we've only really gotten to the beginning here, only scratched the surface. So I hope readers will come to read the whole book. It's called, again, Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson. Isabel, such a pleasure having you on again.
Thank you so much.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. David Hill joins us now from Nyack, New York. He is the author of the book, The Vapors, A Southern Family, The New York Mob, and The Rise and Fall of Hot Springs, America's Forgotten Capital of Vice. David, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This is your first book. Is this the book that you knew you always wanted to write, or did you have other aims and ambitions and somehow you ended up here back in your hometown, so to speak?
I can't say that this is the book I always wanted to write. I mean, I kind of came to writing later in life. I spent about 15 years as a union organizer before I kind of switched gears and started writing.
But it's the obvious next move.
In some ways it is. I think I learned a lot about storytelling and listening to people. I learned a bit growing up in Arkansas about how to tell stories too. And when I started writing, I did sort of think early on that I wanted to write about Hot Springs because it's just a part of my life that people I meet outside of Arkansas are always so fascinated by.
Why is that? What's the fascination with Hot Springs? For those who've never heard of Hot Springs, Arkansas, what is this place?
Well, Hot Springs, it's a resort town. It's a national park, which a lot of folks don't realize. It's the smallest national park in America. And for a long time, it was a major resort in America because for many years, people would come there to take baths in the hot mineral springs, the hot water. I mean, for a long time, doctors around the world thought that this hot natural water cured a lot of illnesses. So that's why around the world, towns that had these springs became resort towns, whether it's Baden-Baden or Saratoga Springs or, you know, Palm Springs. I mean, these places, you know, developed around that hot water. Hot Springs was no different, but it's what I write about in the book and what Hot Springs really became notorious for was being the largest illegal gambling operation in America from the years of about 1927 till 1967. And when I say that, I mean, it was for quite a while. Even it was Las Vegas before Las Vegas was Las Vegas. It was America's kind of first gambling capital. It surprises people to learn that. I think people are often shocked that this is a bit of history that they don't know, right? It seems impossible to people that something like this could have existed and nobody's ever told them about it.
What was it like for you growing up in Hot Springs?
Well, I grew up there in the 1980s and the gambling business was not that far gone at that point. So I kind of grew up around the relics of all of this, but it was also a time when I think Hot Springs was trying to distance itself from that reputation of being a bit of a sin city. So, you know, I grew up there when there wasn't any more casino gambling, but there were definitely, you know, all the empty casinos had become things like wax museums or churches, or so there were still these massive empty hotels and luxury high-rise towers and elegant buildings that had once housed all these casinos that were now kind of empty and a bit of a ghost town.
Was there a sort of economic depression fallout from the shutdown of the gambling industry?
Absolutely. It was definitely the bedrock of the economy in Hot Springs. And so shutting down gambling just pulled the rug right out from under them. They tried to make a go of it for a while as being kind of a family resort and hoped that tourists would continue to come to the city without gambling, that they would come to take a show or, you know, come to visit the lakes or stay in one of these, you know, elegant hotels. But it just didn't take. The tourists really stopped coming after the roulette wheel stopped spinning.
How did your family end up there? Because one of the people you write about in your book, one of the stories you tell is the story of your grandmother, Hazel Hill. So your roots seem to go way back in Hot Springs.
Right. My grandmother, she moved to Hot Springs from Ohio. Her father was a horse trainer. He worked the circuit, kind of begging hat in hand for horses to work. And he stayed on the road following the horses. He took her along with him when she was about 16. And when they were in Hot Springs for the race meet at Oaklawn, which is the racetrack there in Hot Springs, he left her behind and she ended up getting married fairly young and took up with the Hill family. So that's kind of how she ended up in Hot Springs, was by following her horse race trainer dad.
Why did you decide to tell her story as part of this book?
Well, I knew I wanted to do, you know, to have some sort of personal entry into this history of the town, but I don't come from important stock. You know, none of my folks were that crucial to sort of the building of the gambling business or the, and so it was difficult to figure out how to do that. But I'd always been fascinated by my grandmother's life. I mean, she definitely had a rough go. She had a fairly harrowing time during those years. And I wanted to investigate her and my father and his brother's life during this time. And what I found was that it actually worked well to balance out the stories of people like Dane Harris and Oney Madden, who are the other two characters in the book, because I think I show the sort of rich and powerful men who made the city, but also show, I think Hazel is sort of an avatar for all the working people of Hot Springs that were also impacted by all the decisions those men made and the people who pushed the brooms and carried the trays and dealt the cards and how their lives were impacted.
You said she had a hard time, your grandmother. What was it like? What happened to her?
Well, she was a victim of domestic abuse, and she and her husband both became alcoholics at a fairly young age. Eventually, her husband commits suicide and widows her with three sons and an addiction problem. She takes up with another man who gets her addicted to pills. She kind of becomes a junkie for, you know, a lot of her boy's life. And so, you know, she's taking odd jobs and she's working in casinos or she's working at lunch counters, doing what she can. But for the most part, she's allowing sort of this rich man who got her hooked on drugs to support her. And there was a lot of tragedy in her life, and she made some tough decisions. She made some bad decisions. But while Hot Springs was kind of a freewheeling town with a lot of folks making a lot of money and having a good time, I think Hazel's life shows that, like, you know, other people were paying a pretty serious cost.
How did the circumstances of her life sort of tie into that larger narrative? In other words, her story sounds like it could happen anywhere in this country and does, sadly. But what was it particular to Hot Springs that maybe brought this out, enabled it, encouraged it?
I don't know that I would say that it's particularly Hot Springs. I agree with you that these kinds of things were happening everywhere, particularly in the middle of the last century. There was, you know, a lot of alcoholism and domestic violence and drug abuse was on the rise during that same period of time. But I think Hazel was attracted to Hot Springs. And I think a lot of people like her were attracted to Hot Springs because it offered nightlife and excitement and it had an energy to it. It drew people in who were looking for a good time. And some people could handle that good time and other people couldn't. I think what's interesting here is that Arkansas is the Deep South, right? This town is nestled in the Bible Belt. in the Delta region. And the fact that this exists there is so unusual. So it really was drawing a lot of folks in who in that area didn't have access to the kinds of things that existed in Hot Springs. And so it really became a bit of a sin city. You know, there are some folks that can handle sin and then there are others that can't.
So the obvious question is, how did this happen in Hot Springs? I mean, other than having those natural springs there, you mentioned the year 1927. What happened in that year?
Well, they elected the mayor of the town, this guy named Leo McLaughlin, who ran on a platform of, you know, if you elect me, I will allow everybody to open up casinos and we'll use that money to pave the roads and string up electric lights and whatnot. And he gets elected in a landslide and he remains mayor for the next 20 years. He's he is a fairly gregarious character, but it wasn't really him alone. I mean, he sort of, what he did was he organized a political machine that controlled every elected office in the town. And that's really how it worked for a long time, was that every single elected official in Hot Springs, from the mayor down to the dog catcher, had to be in on the situation. And the governor of the state had to be in on it too. And as long as those folks were all playing ball, then they could operate this Las Vegas type gambling with impunity.
The title of your book is The Vapors, and that refers to a specific nightclub founded by Dane Harris. What was The Vapors like? What role did it play in the city?
Well, The Vapors opens in 1960, and at that point, gambling in Hot Springs was at its apex. I mean, things were really rolling, and there's millions and millions of visitors every year, and they're making hundreds of millions of dollars a year from gambling. So Hot Springs really was, in 1960, rivaling Las Vegas in so many ways. And Dane Harris becomes the boss gambler of the town, and he opens up a club called The Vapors, which really was his vision for what he thought Hot Springs could be. It was an elegant nightclub. It was a lot more like what you'd find in New York City than what you might find in Las Vegas or even in Hot Springs at that time. You know, there were two different types of casinos. There were what you called sawdust joints, which were kind of no-frills places with sawdust on the floor where, so that people could just spit their tobacco out. And then what were people called carpet joints, which were casinos with carpet on the floor that would kind of appeal to a higher class, I suppose. But The Vapors was going to be a carpet joint. But really, his vision was that he would spend a lot of money to bring in top flight entertainment and put on these big shows at The Vapors, which is something nobody had really tried doing in casinos before. And he did it with aplomb. I mean, it was successful. It brought in tourists. You know, they advertised their shows all over the country on radio ads and newspaper ads and brought in tourists from all over the world to Hot Springs to see entertainment at The Vapors. I mean, people were premiering their Broadway shows in Hot Springs at The Vapors before they took them to Broadway. There were a lot of acts that were on retainer that would, you know, stay in Hot Springs for months at a time to work on their acts. So it really became a cultural capital in America during that stretch.
The Vapors, you said, opened only in 1960, but by 1965, all this gets shut down by Hoover and by Robert F. Kennedy. What happened?
Kennedy had been trying to shut down gambling in Hot Springs for a while. I think it really irked a lot of folks in the Justice Department that Hot Springs could do this in sort of bold-faced, you know, defiance of the law. This wasn't like back alley kind of speakeasy type stuff. I mean, these were wide open casinos with big marquees. Like I said, they were advertising all over the country, but they needed federal legislation that would permit the federal government to come in and shut this down. So first he had to pass a bunch of laws, and there was a bit of a cat and mouse game that goes on for a number of years between the Department of Justice and the gamblers of Hot Springs. What really did them in the end was an internecine war between the various factions of gamblers in Hot Springs that were allowed to run casinos and weren't, and various mob factions that were involved with them. And so this war resulted in bombings and places getting blown up and people's houses and cars getting blown up, including the Vapors being bombed. And I think what that did was turn the good citizens of Arkansas solidly against gambling, and they put a lot of pressure on the governor to put an end to it finally.
How did the New York mob get down there to begin with?
Well, a man named Oney Madden was a big time, you know, mob boss in New York City during Prohibition. And he's a British gangster who kind of became a West Side leader of the Irish mob. And he goes to jail for murder. And when he gets out, because back in those days, you could actually get out of jail for murder somehow. Prohibition was over. The mob had turned to gambling as their source of income, and they were very interested in Hot Springs. So he gets kind of dispatched to Hot Springs because he needed to get out of New York. And they tell him he should go check out Hot Springs. He goes there and he ends up getting married to a local woman and spends the rest of his life there as kind of the mob's man in Arkansas.
So who bombed the Vapors? Did they ever find out? And was it destroyed?
They rebuilt the Vapors after it was bombed. To this day, it remains an unsolved crime. The FBI had some pretty strong suspects that they were following up on that I talk about in the book. But it seems pretty clear that whoever actually bombed the Vapors, that the motive for bombing it was folks who were angry that they were not allowed to operate their own casinos in Hot Springs and wanted to see the Vapors and Dane Harris and the folks that were operating casinos in Hot Springs to be run out of town.
What about the nightclub, the building itself of the Vapors? Is that still standing?
It's still standing. It was in operation till the early 90s. They kept it running as a nightclub and then a disco and then a honky tonk. Eventually, they turned it into a church. And during the year that my family lived in Arkansas writing the book, it was still a church. From what I understand, it's been purchased now and somebody's trying to turn it back into a nightclub.
Wow. So you are talking to me from Nyack, New York. You obviously don't live in Hot Springs anymore. And we are in roughly a pretty strong state of quarantine still. Was it originally part of your plan to go down to Hot Springs and have some events around the book there?
Definitely. I really regret that I wasn't able to get down there and sign books for people and do events to promote the book. But we've been doing a lot of things on Zoom and that's been good.
What's the response been like from people in Hot Springs and seeing the history of their town explored in a book in this way?
The response has been very positive. I've been very pleased to see that folks in Hot Springs are excited about the book. And my uncle, Larry, I just talked to him on the phone the other day. He's in the book. He's the only surviving child of Hazel's. He said that people have been asking him for his autograph.
Huh. Well, hopefully for the paperback release, you'll get to go back to Hot Springs and have some more events down there.
I sure hope so.
All right, David, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for asking me.
David Hill is the author of The Vapors, A Southern Family, The New York Mob, and The Rise and Fall of Hot Springs, America's Forgotten Capital of Vice. Dwight Garner is here, and he is going to turn the tables on me by asking the questions. So without further ado, over to you, Dwight.
Good morning, Pamela.
Good morning.
You know, I was just thinking this morning, you know, that my life as a book critic, I've always written from home since I've started this job at the Times, and my life has changed very little under COVID. But, you know, you ran a large operation from the New York Times mothership, and 6 months into COVID, what's it like running it from home now?
You know, I think we've established a kind of mode of operation at this point. So all of the kinks have been worked out, which isn't to say that we're happy entirely with the way it stands. I mean, I have to say, I really do miss human beings. I miss books. I've been into the office 3 times since we shut down. One was almost immediately afterwards. It seemed like we just realized right away, like, wait, how could we have left all of that stuff back there? So I went in with a colleague the first time and we left with suitcases and suitcases. And then I went back a second time and think that 167 packages had arrived in the interim. And that was really not what it normally would have been because most places had stopped sending mail because everyone else was shut down too. So it was really just a fraction of what we'd normally have there. And the third time I went back, I have to say, it wasn't with any real imperative. I mean, I did need to clear out some accumulation of mail, but it was almost an emotional visit for me. I just needed to be back in there among the books. I do miss, there's an excitement to being around people, but there's also an excitement to being around those books, to kind of seeing titles and objects that surprise you that you didn't know were coming and just to kind of look through them. There's just something you get in that exposure that I certainly am not getting working from home.
Pamela, you know, as you know, I was an editor at the Book Review for a long time, and I remember the system and how it works. Publishers send a copy of every book into the Book Review, addressed to your name, addressed to the editor-in-chief's name, and you and a few people open them, and then you give them to the appropriate reader at the Times Book Review, because you have people that are specialized in fiction and in history and different topics, and you hand them out, and those people read the books. And anyway, I'm wondering, now that there aren't physical books, and I'm wondering now that you're not all there, how this system works. How does a book go from, you know, the publisher to the Book Review, and how does it get assigned now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So before we even get to the distribution of books, there are ways that we're learning about books so that when the physical galleys come in, the review copies for us to distribute, hopefully we're not coming at them completely blind, but have some sense of what these books are. And so the ways that we normally find out about books, there are a few ways. One is that we get catalogs, physical catalogs, and publishing companies that aren't producing physical catalogs will sometimes produce them for us, some simulacrum of what a catalog would be. Even if it's just photocopies of something that they printed out from online. So we get all of those and we look through them. We also get the trade magazines, you know, Kirkus and Publishers Weekly, and we see online sources for most anticipated books lists. So we kind of know what's coming. The third way is that publishers will host lunches in which they usually have a group of authors, but sometimes one author in a more intimate setting talking about the book, and the editor will be there. The editor or the publisher will talk about the book. You really get a sense of the backstory of a book and what it's about and the opportunity to ask questions. And then the other way we find out is that most of the publishers, from big to small, will come into our offices on a regular basis and meet with a small group of lead editors on the book review side, but also your own editor, John Williams, will come, and the news and features editors will come, and we'll kind of meet with them, and they'll talk through their lists, and they'll tell us about what's coming. They'll tell us about any big embargoes, any celebrity books, but also kind of up-and-coming debuts. So all of those mechanisms have basically gone away. But what's happened is that there are some kind of facsimile of each of them available to us. And as you can imagine, a lot of it happens on Zoom or Google Hangout. So we're still doing all that stuff. It just happens now on screen. The harder thing is that, you know, you remember this, when you get the physical galley, it is an object and you can look at it, and it's not just about the marketing. It's not just what's on the back cover and what's on the front cover and, you know, the design and all of that, but you can turn to the table of contents. There is often promotional material inside that tells you a little bit more about the book because, you know, it's hard to judge within a few minutes, not whether the book should be reviewed or not, but which editor should be the one to just make that decision. You need something to go on. And so all of that stuff that we are now doing via Zoom, that helps inform us, but it's still hard because the distribution of these galleys, which used to happen, again, physical books in a room with a dumpster, with mail containers that, you know, with the name of each of our preview editors on it for us to put the physical galleys in, that's all gone. It now happens on a spreadsheet. And that can feel very opaque when you're just looking at a title and an author and a publisher to be like, wait a minute, what was that book? So there's a lot of, you know, Googling and trying to remember. And we are book people, but right now we are really spreadsheet and database people. We have a spreadsheet that keeps track of everything in a program called Airtable. We have this internal database that we use to keep a record of every book that comes in through the door, so to speak. So we're still doing all of that. It's just a little harder and a little less fun.
So are you sending reviewers now instead of books, instead of galleys, are you sending them PDFs?
Yes, they're mostly using NetGalley or Edelweiss or PDFs. And, you know, as you know, Dwight, we have a system here at the Book Review where publishers are insulated from our reviewers and vice versa. So they don't know who's reviewing it, which means that we are the intermediary. Now, in a physical office, a galley will be sent by us to the reviewer. The publisher has no idea. Now we have to kind of set up this elaborate system where we still have to make sure that they don't know who is reviewing our books so that things are not going directly between a publisher and a reviewer, but instead, you know, that there's some kind of wall. And we are trying to avoid physical copies for health reasons. You know, each physical copy that needs to be mailed out requires the publisher often to go to a UPS or a FedEx or a USPS office, and then it requires us to do the same thing, and that also adds time. So, you know, there are just these extra steps, and things are also tougher with books that are embargoed, which is to say books that, because they have something of news value or perhaps something a little bit risky in them, where they have a very clear date at which you can go public with the information. That's easier to handle when it's a physical copy. I mean, I remember, you know, back when the new, quote unquote, new Harper Lee book came out, like having a handoff, you know, in an elevator with that physical book. And actually, it was in the lobby. And I remember going up in the elevator thinking, I have it here in my hands, you know. That doesn't happen when it's all electronic. And so, you know, there are security measures that have been put into place, but it's just not the same thing. And it's lost a little bit of the kind of cloak and dagger aspect to it.
Right. You mentioned to me, I think you mentioned somewhere, going to a virtual book party, which sounds like a very sad kind of book party. I'm wondering what these virtual book parties are like.
Well, I should say I've only been to one virtual book party since the quarantine, and that was a special book party because I hosted it for one of our own colleagues, Barry Guin, whose first book.
Well, that was a great party. I attended that party.
You came to that party.
So I will retract my these sound depressing line. Maybe our listeners don't know, but you know, often a publisher will throw a party of some sort for a writer when his or her book comes out, and a lot of publishing people will go to them, and those are clearly over now. So writers are having trouble getting you know, that kind of attention.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, book parties, it is fun and it is a party, but there is a work reason, there is a work benefit to having these kinds of in-person events, whether it's a luncheon or a book party. And that is that editors and critics and journalists and people who work in the industry are getting together in a physical space, and we're talking, we're exchanging information, we're also exchanging our opinion, you know, and that's lost in a Zoom, for example. So I can see that all the people I used to see at an actual lunch are there, but we aren't able to chat to the side and be like, hey, what do you really think of this book? Or what are you really excited about that's coming out next month? Or did you hear about X, Y, and Z? So, you know, a lot of that is just really fun gossip that's gone, but it's also really interesting bits of information, you know, and you find out about books that you didn't know about, you learn interesting things about the industry, and that is just all completely evaporated. And I think it's greatly missed because our days are so busy. I don't have time to email a colleague working in the same field, whether they're at O Magazine or at Kirkus or, you know, at the National Book Foundation, and be like, you know, do you have time for some idle gossip for 5 minutes? You know, it just doesn't happen.
Right. Well, I remember, you know, before COVID, the last bit of gossip that I remember, people were talking about how the election was or was not going to work this fall publishing season. What's your sense of that now?
I think it's, you know, been sort of rewarped in another way in that, I mean, two major things have happened. This was going to be the year of an election, a really pivotal election. It was going to be such a big deal that FSG, for example, for our Strauss and Giroux, decided, you know, what we're really going to do with our list is focus on fiction and make this the year of fiction and sort of do a counter programming. So publishers are really coming out with plans of what to do. And the main reason for this is that the assumption was not only that people's attention would be diverted during the election, and that's actually less of a factor than you might think, because it's not like, you know, people stop going to Marvel movies or, you know, whatnot just because there is an election going on. People still have varied interests and full lives. It's really a more pragmatic concern in that books that require major media attention, broadcast attention from television or radio, cannot get a secure booking from one of those news outlets during an election season because they will almost always get bumped for news. And this is very difficult, just in practical terms. You know, you have an author, say, from Idaho, who flies in to be on the Today Show to find out, whoops, you got bumped because Biden's new vice president candidate is saying such and such and is going to come on. So they can't do all that. So they avoid the fall. Now, that's not really so much a factor as you've had two things intervene. One, obviously, is the coronavirus and the quarantine. But the second thing has been the whole Black Lives Matter movement and protests. So you have these two major news developments that have led to a rush of books that are coming out as soon as fall. And also, there were many books that had to have their publication date deferred. And so books that
those are all coming now, right?
That's, yeah. They're all going to come out, or they're going to come out in 2021. And so there's actually a backload of books this fall. And one of the other things that I think people didn't bank on happening is that there is a potential major backlog at the printers, because the printing capacity in this country in particular has become very constrained. There are two major printers, and one of them has been in bankruptcy, and the other one had an outbreak of COVID earlier this year. And then you have the factor of, you know, many books are produced in China and overseas in Asia, and there might be delays there. So
all of that kind of back end stuff is a little bit up in the air too. So it's a really weird year.
Have you, Pamela, been in a bookstore since lockdown, since COVID?
I have been. They still haven't been in a library, which is really a bummer. Our library is now open in a kind of limited way with reservations. But given the demands of my workday, I just haven't been able to go to the local library. I have, however, gone to a Barnes & Noble in the area, and it was really interesting to see the ways in which that has been kind of transformed. They've really changed the layout of the store.
How so?
You know, I went there actually with my kids. All my book emergencies have been with my kids because they're very fast, you know, voracious readers, and a lot of, you know, middle grade books and YA books are super fast. So by the time you get home from the store, it's like they read one in the back seat. It's very right. frustrating. You know, normally a lot of these we would have gotten from the library, but that's just not an option or hasn't been an option for a while. So there are fewer books. I noticed that in particular, there was much less of a variety, but the tables are more spread out. The aisles are wider. The display tables aren't as deep. I think they're really looking at ways to spread out foot traffic for safety reasons.
Are you getting out of the house? And how are you getting out of the house? And I'm sure you're being careful, but I'm just wondering what your sort of life is like these days.
You know, it's been very, very staid. I sort of hit a wall last weekend and went to the beach. I went out to Robert Moses Beach on Long Island last weekend and had so much fun that we planned to go again this weekend. I had not been to a beach since January. And when I went to the beach in January, it was not an ocean wave kind of beach. It was more of a sort of like bay kind of beach where you don't have that fun of just being in the waves and being on a wide open stretch of land. That was very necessary. I'm not getting away at all this summer other than these occasional, what I hope now become occasional beach visits.
That sounds perfect. I'm actually going to the beach, well, to a lake this weekend. And, you know, it's vacations have become more special, haven't they? Because they feel so rare and just so sort of like you're sneaking off and you're, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, my vacations have been canceled. We had a vacation to visit my in-laws and an extended family in LA in April, and a plan to visit my brother who lives in the Bay Area and his family in August. And both of those are gone. So we don't really have any plans to travel until 2021. I think I've been sort of fantasizing about all the money that I'm saving up on like my commuter ticket and dry cleaning, and these lost vacations will all be, I hope, like ball together into some massive occasion to Japan or Italy or something really exciting in 2021 or 2022.
Well, I am so with you. And Pamela, thanks for this. What I'm hoping is just to, God, see you and you know, see my colleagues at the Book Review again sometime soon. This whole thing has gotten a little wild. It's great to hear your voice. And thank you for submitting to some questions.
Well, I hope I answered them. Thanks so much, Dwight. It's so much fun talking to you.
Thanks, Pamela. Talk to you soon.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that enables your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.